नमो तस्स भगवतो अवहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अवहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अवहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि. Dear friends, the Buddha image that you see behind me is one of the earth-touching Buddha. You can see that the Buddha's hand is down in that gesture of touching the earth. This is part of the story of the full enlightenment of the Buddha, which happened on the Vesak full moon, which would be remembered 1 week from today. Before the Buddha obtained his awakening, he had studied with different meditation teachers. He had tried systems of thought, systems of meditation. He had practiced extreme austerities, going without sleep, going without breath, going without food, and realized with his tremendous integrity and his great honesty that these practices that he had tried, following the examples of the religious traditions of the time, that these ways were not taking him to the goal, to realizing the destruction of dukkha, the end of suffering. And then he happened to recall when he had been a small child, on the occasion of the plowing festival in the spring, which is something that we commemorate today. This is the quarter moon, 1 week before the Vesak. We remember that day when the Bodhisattva Siddhartha, as a young child, was taken out to the park and placed in the shade of the rose apple tree while his family and all the people of the city were celebrating the beginning of the farming season, and his father, the king, was driving the plow to cut the first furrow in the garden. It says in the sutta that the Buddha recollected that he had experienced samadhi. He had experienced deep meditation. He had experienced the blissful enjoyment of meditation. And he recognized that this happiness of meditation is not at all the same thing as the sensual pleasures which stir up greed, stir up disappointment, stir up hatred, stir up clinging and craving, and stir up so many problems. But instead, there's this other kind of happiness, the happiness of letting go, the happiness of being secluded from those, actually secluded from sensuality. And it's because of that this week, actually, these past 2 weeks, I've had a personal a wish to really try to practice and be aware of meditation itself and what a tremendous boon, what a tremendous benefit it is for us to be able to, from time to time, have the ability to sit down and to take a rest from all of the activities that we must be involved with all day long. I know some of us are of the retirement age, and perhaps we don't have as many chores as we used to have when we were younger. We had to be out there plowing the field, taking care of the cattle, taking care of the horses, taking care of the children, taking care of the employees, taking care of the crops, worrying about the weather, making everything be done on a timely basis, having things be organized so that the crops could come in at the right time, worrying in fear. Maybe it was going to have some kind of a freak storm or a weather event that your crop would be ruined even after you had spent so much effort and energy putting into it. And so then this whole struggle for survival is something that is constantly keeping the mind on the move, doing the next thing that should be done. Now, this is not yet even talking about there's nothing evil or unwholesome about earning one's livelihood in an honest way. But nevertheless, the habit of grasping, the habit of clinging, the habit of worrying, the habits that can lead to the arising of anger, can lead to wars, all of those things are part and parcel of this churning along of the continuous activity of the mind as we are planning our different activities directed to our own survival and the materialistic survival of our loved ones. So then, this habit of being activated can really make a person sick. It's so important to know how to stop and how to rest, how to rest the mind, how to stop the hunt, stop the pursuit, just merely to be still. Even in a certain way, if you look at the animals, a lot of animals don't necessarily spend that many hours of the day hunting and prowling and getting their food in that way. That it seems almost like animals know how to really rest when it's their downtime, how to really relax. And we've sort of forgotten that. So we have to learn intentionally and make the effort and learn how to relax the mind. There's a something in a secular common lore about the way scientific inventions work. They say that the scientist is, collecting his or her data and observing a phenomenon, and measuring things in a very a careful way, and seeing how the theories fit in with reality. And this is what humans do all the time. You're continuously setting up theories about what you think is the nature of things, and see whether what you experience is agreeing with your theory about what's really going on. From time to time, that scientist could discover some kind of anomaly where the observations are not matching up with the theory, something that they cannot explain, that they don't really understand why it's happening like this. This was, in a way, the Buddhist quest, wasn't it? In the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Sutta on the Noble Quest, that's 26 in the Middle Length Discourses, the Buddha was saying, why do humans suffer? And, well, they suffer from old age and death. Why do they have old age and death? They have old age and death because of birth. Why do they have birth? They have birth because of becoming. And then so on, Bodhisattva was seeking and seeking and seeking, looking for the real answer, finally to find the answer that would unlock this riddle about why humans suffer so much. So when a scientist is working on a problem, he struggles and struggles and struggles and works very hard and makes a lot of measurements and runs a lot of experiments and really squinches up his brow and thinks and it's very filled with effort and still doesn't find the answer to the question. And then according to the story or the lore, he goes to sleep and then stops struggling and striving, just goes to rest. And then in a dream, the answer appears. So the answer to the question appears at a moment of stillness and relaxation. The truth is able to arise not by our willpower or by our struggle or by our effort or by pushing, but instead after we've, hopefully in a balanced way, we do make the good effort, we do struggle, we do strive, but then we also know how to relax and let go. And then the truth that we're able to realize emerges. It's a course of nature. It emerges in that place of stillness. And then so it is for that reason that the learning how to develop sama samadhi, right tranquility or right meditation, sometimes called right concentration, how it's so important to develop that practice. Before this Vaisak season at Dhammadharini, we had our winter retreat. And during the winter retreat, we studied Bhikkhu Anālaya's book called Compassion and Emptiness. And in that book, I was very impressed to see how Bhikkhu Anālaya emphasized that sometimes Westerners, because of our culture, the way we are raised and the way we think, try too hard to gain samadhi. We're too much goal-oriented, too rigid or too tight in trying to get samadhi, and then are frustrated in not being able to accomplish entering into jhana, not able to have that wonderful, blissful and still transformative kind of experience of deep meditation. But Anālaya says that the practice of loving-kindness and the Brahma-viharas is actually the softer, gentler way to arrive at samadhi. It's the more natural, intuitive, kindly way that a person could come to this deeper meditation. And the way that he teaches not just compassion, but also the whole four divine abidings of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. There's two basic models that we sometimes hear about for these practices. One is directed towards persons. You may have been taught to develop the thought of loving kindness towards your own self, towards the beloved dear one who might be a teacher or a mentor, somebody who's inspiring, but somebody who's very lovable, and then towards a neutral person, and then last of all, towards an enemy or a difficult person, and learn how in a sequence to develop loving kindness towards all of those four kinds of people, so that it doesn't matter what kind of person it is, whether it's your own self, your dearly beloved, some neutral person you barely know, or your enemy, that loving kindness is just kindness. It just is the same for any kind of person. And that kind of practice is, in my experience, and the way I was trained with that practice, it can be really great for learning how to overcome hindrances. I was trained to attempt or develop loving kindness, starting with oneself, and to notice the feeling connected to loving kindness. The feeling is kind of like the learning sign. There's a certain, for most people, a pleasant feeling, either a pleasant feeling or a neutral feeling, that's connected to loving kindness. And so if you're practicing that loving kindness meditation and you're keeping an eye on that feeling of kindness, then at some point, if the mind gets distracted and you lose the thought of loving kindness and start thinking about something else, or the mind goes to something else, goes to drowsiness or goes to something else, then the feeling disappears. And so the feeling is like the barometer that helps you to keep the meditation right in the track. And because the feeling of kindness is pleasant, then you want to do it. But if you are unable to practice loving kindness for yourself, and this can happen with some people, no matter how much they try, they can't for 10 breaths in a row hold on to that thought of kindness for themselves, or they can't hold it for 10 minutes or 20 minutes. They can't have a sustained thought of wishing for their own happiness. And then, as I was taught, the training that I was given was then, okay, there's something that's an obstacle that's blocking the thought of kindness. What is it? And so you got to find out what that obstacle is. It might be that it's a self-hatred, or it could be like self-doubt, that you think that you don't deserve happiness or something like that. And so whatever the hindrance is, you got to then find out how to take care of the hindrance, to learn how to let go, to overcome that hindrance. And so when you finally overcome all of the hindrances involved with being kind to yourself, then you can do that practice. Then you're allowed to go to the next person, the dear person. And then why sometimes people get distracted and they can't hold the meditation on giving kindness to that dear person. And I was taught it could be because there's a certain amount of greed involved in the dear person. You would like them to love you back. And so that kind of longing or something makes the meditation unstable. Anyway, that's that whole practice. So it's somewhat of a busy practice. It's kind of like a thinking practice, but it is a practice that is worth doing to discover, to uncover, and to realize some of the negative habits of the mind that we may have. So that kind of loving kindness is particularly bring into mind different types of people. And it's with respect to people, isn't it, that all of our bad mental habits come up much more so in connection to people than anything else. But the training that Analeo gave was quite different than that. He emphasized on the boundless practice of simply taking up the thought of kindness, compassion, and so forth, and to visualize radiating kindness in all the directions. Just that simple practice. And that simple practice is very conducive to stillness. And in a certain kind of way, the boundless radiation of kindness and the Brahmaviharas is not completely a different than the boundless aspect of the space element. And then it comes to, there's a certain way in which the natural, intuitive, beautiful, calming effect of loving kindness meditation, helping the mind to come to stillness, when it's being done in this boundless way, it also, if a person has practiced doing elements meditation also is very helpful in helping the mind to calm down and settle down, because the elements are not emotional. The hardness of your skull and the hardness of the earth is just the earth element. The earth element is not getting excited. The earth element is not getting angry. The earth element is not filled with greed. So they say, like, what you are paying attention to becomes the inclination of the heart. And so when the mind is directed towards elements, it also becomes calm, detached from emotions, and you don't even have to think. There's a little there's something you could say if you wanted to talk to yourself during the earth element meditation or during elements meditation, which is in contemplating the element to realize, oh, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. And so it's possible, it's given in the sutta, to have that kind of verbal understanding about the elements, but also it can simply be experienced directly. How the identification of with the self and all of the troubles that are that come from that is arising because of, you know, what we have to defend, what we have to protect, trying to get a little bit more life, trying to avoid being annihilated and so forth like that because of this this idea of the self. But when it's just a rock, you know, the rock is not worried. And we can be like a rock. We can be not worried. We can be like the air. We can be like the sky. We can be like the boundlessness of space and be free from worry. So directing the mind in that direction naturally tends to bring the mind towards this space of stillness, which is not making any kind of like assertion about ego or about self. So for a person who wants to wake up, to whatever extent you might be capable to actually realize for yourself the truths that are pointed to by the Blessed One, it is to your advantage to find out how to cultivate samadhi, to cultivate stillness, to cultivate the ability to withdraw the mind from all of the activities that you otherwise must do. And the practice of loving kindness is reliably given, especially this boundless practice. Just simply, you don't have to worry about, you know, there's so many people in the world who need some love right now. There's so many people who are hurting right now. And we wish that each and every one of them could have a chance to come out of the painful situation that they're in. And that's true. That's good. There's nothing the matter with thinking like that. Even the Buddha, the fully enlightened Buddha, used to get up in the morning and he would direct his mind with his divine eye, and he would look over the whole world, and he would see, is there anybody in the whole world who's ready to wake up? And if they just needed some pointer to be able to wake up, then he would go and appear before them and point out the one thing that they were lacking, that was the last barrier to their awakening, and he would help them in that way. So he was looking over diverse myriad of many different kinds of people at all different kinds of stages, but then at other times not involved with that diversity, letting the mind go to simplicity, stillness, seclusion, being disengaged from the contact with the five senses and the feelings that come up from that, and the thoughts and intentions that come up with that, and the perceptions that come up with that, and the stories that come up with that, and the karma that we do that comes up from that, just disengaging from that whole process, being able to stand back sometimes is to our benefit. This is not to discount the entire Eightfold Path. I think those who are in the room now know enough to realize that you can't just be ignorant, ordinary person who never thought about anything and never tried to be good, and just sit down on a cushion and obtain awakening, that the purification of wrong ideas, the purification of ethics, the discovery even that some of the inner afflictive, like because of whatever trauma a person might have experienced earlier in this life, are just the mere fact of being a human being and having the kind of the animal tendencies that that we possess, that actually we find out by following the teachings of the Buddha that we've got a choice. We don't have to be a puppet who's forever being pulled around by instinct and emotions. Instead, we can choose what type of thoughts to welcome, what kind of intentions to entertain. We have that ability. We have that power. We've already found out how to do that. So I think I may pause here and see if there are any questions. This talk tonight has been improvised. I didn't plan it ahead of time. So I'm sorry if it seemed confusing, but if there's anything that I can make more clear, I welcome your questions. Okay, Patty.
Thank you so much for that beautiful talk. The radiating kindness instead of doing the practice of person by person makes so much sense, and the way you explained it was beautiful. In not having to remember anybody, but it includes everyone in the universe. I love that. And when you mention that, I practice metta all the time. That's like my fallback. But I love radiating to everyone. The way you described it, I don't know whether it was the tone of your voice or what you said, but a certain tenderness sort of burst in my heart. I felt the tender heart opening as you were describing that. And I just want to thank you for that.
These are the words of the Buddha. So if it works, it's because it comes from a good source. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'll call on Zoe.
That was a beautiful talk. And I tried doing a part of the practice while I was listening to you talk about practicing metta for myself, which I'm not used to doing. And it's an interesting experience because it was like different parts of my body were getting loving kindness coming toward myself. And it was almost like a healing for different parts of the body that were hurting. So it was interesting. I was interested also in what you were talking about, the elements, doing a meditation on the elements, and was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit further about what elements specifically you found that are useful to work with.
Thank you. The sutta that I find the most helpful for elements meditation is the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, which is number 140 in the Middle Length Discourses. I take that sutta as being like a guided meditation, like read one sentence and then sit with that for 10 minutes, then read the next sentence and sit with that. The Buddha takes his student first through the six senses. And so it's like waking up all of the senses and the contact. It's like really coming into the present moment through that stage of it. And then he invites to look at the elements. There's four elements: earth, water, fire, and air. The earth element is what's hard. The water element is both what's juicy, and also, if you think about mud, that the water element helps it stick together. So it's got that quality. So dust becomes mud when the water element is added to it. And then the fire element is both the warmth and also the way fire burns, the way the digestion in the body is burning up the body, the way the body is like continuously being consumed. That's like a process of the fire element. And then the air element is involved with wind or motion. So then, like the movement of the breath. In that sutta, it's given actually a very simple, natural way, inside, outside. So your fingernails are like seashells. Your bones are like trees. Your skull is like a boulder. Your teeth are like pebbles. And so you can think of the things within the body, the fleshy part of the body is like the soil, you know, the soil that was being plowed on the plowing festival. So then just think of the earthy aspect of the body and the earthy things outside, the water, like your saliva, the urine in the body and so forth. And then think about like the rain and the flowing of the river and the ocean. And it's just very simple like that. They do say it can be kind of a, some people just get to the earth element and they sort of like stop there. And the meditation can become too like rigid. If they just, so going through the elements, through all four of those. And then in this sutta, he says, after having spent a long time going back and forth with those elements, inside, you go inside and outside the world and inside the body, the world inside the body, until the sense that your own body is any different than the rest of the world sort of evaporates. And then he mentions the space element. And then the space element is both has the quality of emptiness. So when you experience your body as being empty of the self, you can also feel like there's space within your body. And in the whole world, the spacious emptiness of space, and then the quality of shunyata, or emptiness, that the Buddha speaks of as a more of a, with the idea of there's not a self. So like if I take a thing, and if I believe that this thing like has an essence, and every, not just every atom, but every, there's no part of this fist which is not a fist. It's entirely made of fist. It's got this essential quality, and all of it is filled with the fistiness of the fist, and it's got that essence. But that's a false view. That's just a something that the mind does. The mind creates objects like that that have that kind of hard quality of their identity. So, you know, I am sabana, if you might think that, and then you might think that every cell of this form and every vibration of this voice, that it's all sabana. But if you look more deeply, more closely, then it breaks up and you realize that actually there's not a separate thing called sabana. It's not a separate thing. It's a compounded thing that's resulting from the interactions between this form and everything else around it. It's empty of a self, and there's a lot of space inside of sabana. That's how she's able to change. And so I think that for me, the elements meditation, according to that one sutta, there's a couple of others that are also good on the same theme of contemplating elements. But then bring it up as far as the space element. And then let the spaciousness of the space element be the same kind of space as the boundless space that you are filling up with loving kindness when you do the boundless loving kindness meditation.
Thank you.
I'm sorry that my answer was so long, that we're coming up to 7:25. I'm happy to speak to Viv, but tell me if I need to stop, otherwise I'll talk all night. Viv, do you want to have a question?
I won't take up too much time. I just want to say that I really loved everything you had to say. I didn't find anything of it confusing. Some of it validated what I already knew or had thought about, and other things were new to me, and it was beautiful. I just wanted to say thank you.
Okay, good. You're welcome. Thank you, everybody, for your good practice and your patient listening, and for being part of creating such a wonderful community as the Marin Sangha. I really do appreciate and bless what you've been doing for a number of years and continue to do.